while I was waiting, it was a tragic situation. I just sat here and life was going nowhere. Family life was naturally falling apart. Everything that I ever had in life was lost. Everything that I had going for myself was over with. And my future didn't look very promising because I was headed to a state that wanted to convict me of a life sentence. And true, when I got there, 2 years, 6 months later, without a trial, the judge immediately gave me 25 years without any judicial process. Nothing constitutional happened to me in that state. That's how I eventually got out of jail, because everything they did to me was unconstitutional. While in prison in California, things was pretty by the book. California ran the prisons pretty tight, pretty fair. Didn't like being there, but it was ran fair. When I got to Mississippi, it was like going to a third world country. Didn't recognize anything about this country there. The race situation was unbelievably high. Blacks and whites just did not get along.
Mr. Killen, do you have any comments?
It's hard to believe that a convicted member of the KKK would tell his story to a black man. But after a year in the state prison system, locked up in the same medical ward as Edgar Ray Killen, James Stern claims he became Killen's confidant.
Did he ever admit to you any crimes that he committed that no one knows about?
32 cold cases of murders that he personally participated in. He personally performed himself, yes. I says, I'm a black man. I said, you got a few white guys in here who's trying to suck up to you every day, you know, fellow Klansmen. I said, and he says, as you can see in some of the letters he writes, he says, I respect you more than I respect any of them. He said, you're a highly intelligent nigga. And that was the first time he called me the N-word.
By not reacting to the N-word, Stern thinks Killen opened up to him even more.
Now, when he's telling me these things, I already knew no one's going to believe me. I said, Edgar, I said, do you really want your thoughts to get out there? I says, you got to write this stuff down.
Stern claims he did. These are copies of Killen's personal notes to Stern. Jerry Mitchell, a writer for the Clarion Ledger, says a handwriting expert says the writing matches Killen's. In the letters, he calls Stern his friend and claims to take him under his wing. In return, Killen wants Stern to work a deal with the Attorney General Jim Hood, a deal that would set him free and allow him to live the rest of his life with his wife under house arrest. Killen writes, I will confess to the 1964 case and drop all appeals, and something they haven't expected is I'll plead no contest to 32 cold cases. I am sure they suspect I am involved.
Can lead to more people in the KKK being arrested for these civil rights crimes. Do you think it'll be worth it?
No. I don't think anything's worth letting that man out of jail. I don't think...
Not even bringing more people to
justice? I don't think... This is my personal opinion. I don't think what that man has done, and what I now, in my own heart and mind, know what he's done by his own confession, I don't think it can justify letting him out.
The letters claim that Killen even implicates himself in the May 1964 kidnapping and killing of two black men in Meadville, Mississippi. James Ford Seal was convicted of that crime. Killen writes, he did me justice by never telling on me for my role in that long night we took those nigger boys for the ride of their life. The dozens of pages Killen wrote and gave to Stern during the year and a half they were locked up together could not only end Killen's calls for appeal, but it could also take down other KKK members, including the only men still alive who are accused of being a part of the Cheney, Schwerner, and Goodman killings. Killen writes to Stern, we have talked about many issues in the 1964 case, but Richard Willis, Owen Burrish, Pete Harris, Jimmy Snowden should never be exposed. The letter goes on to say that one day all will be gone with God, so no harm could come to anyone.
At religion
that point.
Is what? Stern says, a strong belief backed up by action. That's all any religion is. And the white supremacists said, we're going to make white supremacy the strongest religion that has ever existed. They have succeeded in that. They are not in the process of doing that. Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Confucianism, Judaism, all of these other religions don't come anywhere close to being as strong as the religion of white supremacy. A strong belief backed up by action. So people are in complete disarray. Confusion, which is what the white supremacists do. They confuse people. Well, we got them confused. We're working on getting them all confused sexually. But we have long ago got them confused when it came to the seventh area of activity, religion. All of these dark-skinned people around here killing each other, hitting each other over the head with the Bible, having endless barbershop arguments about what Ezekiel meant or what Solomon did or didn't do or what Ruth said or didn't say. We got them confused. That's what we do. We take any hope.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of the 5W1H Show. I'm your host, Javos, or Racism Counter, as many know me on Instagram as. We're back with another program. This is a book review on the book Mississippi Still Burning by James Hart Stern. And it's very important that I add that it was written by Autumn K. Robinson, a white female. That's very important for reasons, you know, obvious reasons to the experience counter-racist, but I'll get deeper into it once I come across it in the text, and I'll point it out as to why that's important. So one thing before we get in the text, because it's really, you know, informative about the system of race, it reveals a lot, so I don't really want to waste time with, you know, talking about other things, but based on the feedback that I got from my previous program, I think there's a disconnect with the counter-racist way of thought, speech, and action, the way that counter-racists go about things. So one thing that I should have done that I didn't do in my previous programs is define racism. So I'll just give a short working definition of what I define racism as. And I use white supremacy and racism interchangeably. So if you hear one, they're a synonym for me. And the definition goes as a global system of people dedicated to the mistreatment of non-white people through thought, speech, and or action. So that's my short working definition of white supremacy and racism, because I believe that's very important. That can cut down on a lot of confusion. So without further ado, because I'm very excited about this text, full of information, very constructive, reveals a lot about the system of racism, which this program is all about. That's the aim of it. So just a little bit about the text. Let me find my Kindle. It's called Mississippi Still Burning, and is, you know, generally, well, what is it? It's about James Hart Stern, which is a black male who was incarcerated falsely, unjustly, and he ended up being locked up with Edgar Ray Killen, notorious white supremacist that partook or orchestrated the killing of the three civil rights workers of James Chaney, Mickey Schwerner, and Andy Goodman. Very famous case. And there's a lot more that he's tied to that we'll get to in the text. So he ended up being locked up with this stone cold racist in Mississippi as a cellmate. And Mr. Edgar Ray Killen's refinement of racism, I believe he started opening up to Mr. Stern for his own personal benefit. Not his own personal, because it transitioned to what he wanted him to do for his movement. And it, his design was to create mass confusion, but he put it on a personal level and used a lot of deceit, which is one of the top tricks in the system of racism. So I think this will reveal a lot. So that's just basically the gist of the story. He reveals, you know, a lot of the inner workings of the Klan, what happened back in those days. Very direct stuff that I didn't know about. So pretty sure it might be news to people that's, you know, listening. So without further ado, I'll get into the text, which I'm very excited about, as I mentioned. So James Hart Stern, he was a black male, as I mentioned before, and unfortunately he passed away in 2018 or 2019, a year after the text, almost like the day to the release of the book. He passed away from apparently cancer. So unfortunately, you know, there's some questions that I can't even ask or even answer because he's no longer here with us, unfortunately. And like I stated earlier, Autumn K. Robinson, it was written by her, but authored by James Hart Stern, the black male. And there's a connection with, you know, white editors or white writers. They tend to impose their will on text and kind of, you know, sanitize and not be as direct, which I think is an act of, it is an act of racism. And that is immediately felt in this text. So, I mean, early on. And the first, you feel the first presence of a white writer or a white editor with this here, right on page 14. The Klan did just as much as a disservice to the moral white people of America as it did to its other targets. Folly, 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 folly. I don't even think I have to explain how much folly that is, but those are the dangers of having suspected races edit your work, write your work, or have some type of creative control. And I mean, it's felt immediate. And there's a myriad of these type of examples. And yes, we have a Heather Hare mentioned in this also, you know, as a well-meaning suspected racist. But later in that page, there's a lot of truth to, and now the truth of the passage is, of this current passage is, deaths of white traitors in the South, according to Edgar Ray Killen, were a necessary part of the plan to keep the KKK in power and the black race in its place. Like I hear, you know, other counter-racists, attempted counter-racists say, whites cannot be ignorant about racism. You will get in trouble with other whites. You're expected to uphold certain standards. So even if you don't agree totally with an ideology of another said suspected racist or confirmed racist, you're expected to hold a certain standard. And when you cross that line, I think that, you know, you get the clashes that you get amongst white over this, the way the system of racism should be practiced. And these clashes shouldn't be taken as, well, the system is in trouble, or this person is truly for this victim because they're clashing with another suspected racist over the refinement or how to practice racism. They're just fighting over a way to dominate and mistreat another a victim. It's just refinement. So moving on. This early in this text, when it just would describe Mr. Stern's upbringing, he was from the Los Angeles area, and it had a lot of good LA history. Some things connect today. You know, it goes into the Latasha Harlins thing, and it has the Koreans versus the black, all the strife within the community. And it's just chock with lots of rich LA history about race day. There's a mention of the Watts riots, there's a detailed account of that. And Jim Brown is also mentioned in the text and his efforts against, you know, curbing gang violence and doing constructive work in this text. So it is very constructive from the standpoint early of, you know, what Mr. Killen said and the LA history, some good footnotes in LA history from that, from the 60s on to whenever, to the LA riots also, there's a mention. Yeah, so in the chapter entitled Heating Up in the 60s, I can't say written by Mr. Stern, but It is said that an unspoken code came to resolution within the black community of Watts during the riots. For every black person who was killed, three white people were to be killed in vengeance. That seemed impossible, but after dark, it started to manifest. I never heard of that. Like I said, a lot of this stuff is new to me. And, you know, that's not highlighted that black people really engage in counter violence against racism. So I've thought that was, you know, very important to note, because sometimes we get bogged down with the notion that blacks don't fight back or we're cowards and whatnot. But there's been a myriad of examples of counter violence exhibited by black people. And this is just another example of that. And it goes on to say later, the rate of killing on both sides led to the National Guard being called into Watts and martial law taking over the area. The chiefs of police came in to have their way. Politicians started talking, and it quickly became evident that there will be no winners at the end of the day. Well, with those two passages, I merged them into one. But with those two passages, I would just say, I know some people would say, hey, you see, counter violence works. You see, the National Guard came in and stopped everything. But my question would be, who does the National Guard actually work for? Who deployed them? Did the system or did the people? So keep that in mind, because it could have just totally went left and just say, oh, well, you know, these are, you know, some unruly niggers, lawless niggers, outlaw niggers running rampant. We need to put them down. It could have easily went that way. So we can't just say, okay, this is the way. Just think logically about the situation. And, you know, it may be the answer. It may not, but think logically. Do your research. Come to your own conclusion. There's a myriad of examples of history of, you know, those type of instances, and we could just look at the result of that. So moving on to the next chapter entitled Coming to Crisis in the 1970s and 1980s. On page 23, it stated, integration doesn't come easily. Where Watts had become famous for the riots in the 1960s, it's transformed into a place that was famous for its gangs in the 1970s. And I would say to that, you see the refinement. You know, we had these black people fighting back. We decided to deploy the National Guard to, you know, clear up this melee, clear up this thing going on. And, you know, I'm so refined, me speaking as the white supremacist, I'm so refined, I don't have to take direct vengeance against you. I'm just going to gentrify the neighborhood. I'm going to, you know, turn it into a ghetto. I'm going to make the conditions as to what Watts became. And, you know, you'll have gangs, you know, now put drugs into the communities, and, you know, you'll be, you know, robbing and stealing and killing each other. There'll be a lot of anti-blackness going on. So that's the refinement of the system. And I think that's important to, you know, if you see an act, look at what came behind it. Look at the result decades later or 5 years later. Just look at it over time and just to see the result, to see if it's truly effective. Let me get back into the text. Also, yeah, there's a mention, Mr. Stern, you know, he wasn't all the way ignorant about racism like all of us are. We're ignorant to a degree, but, you know, he was a little less confused. He even made a connection with the CIA dropping drugs within the community. He made that connection, which I thought was, you know, very important. We need to get that out as much as possible. And he did that also in his text. Let's move on. He talked about a lot of the, you know, the situation, like a lot of the gang violence, how rampant it became, and a lot of tragedies with, you know, children, women being killed through mistaken identity and whatnot. There's a, you know, myriad of those examples in it. And when I read this passage, I thought the religion of white supremacy. That's what you hear, Mr. Fuller, in the beginning of the program. In chapter 2, it starts off like this. Edgar Ray Killen was an ordained preacher for decades in Mississippi. His nickname among the people of his community was the preacher. Now keep that in mind. He's an ordained preacher, and just listen to his views throughout his life. And I mean, he professed, you know, Christianity up until probably he died, but he was in prison as an old man, still professing this holiness type thing. So it was important to see that, you know, our idea of Christianity and theirs are two different things. White supremacy seems to be the religion of the races, and religion is defined as a belief backed up by action. And they have just demonstrated that through centuries, not even decades, centuries. Moving on. Oh, yeah, the next part. The white writer, like I said, the handprints of a white writer or a white editor is all throughout this text. And here's another example of it. Armand Hammer's support for me was an echo of support that white philanthropists and white activists gave to cause of black freedom back to the beginnings of slavery. It was an echo of John Brown, Susan B. Anthony, William Wilberforce, John F. Kennedy, Harriet Beecher Stowe, Abraham Lincoln, William Seward, Andy Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and so many more. These were men and women who believed that no one could be truly free until those in bondage had the same rights as you and me. Folly, folly, and more folly. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln, I mean, he was, I'm not going to name call suspected racist, but he told racist jokes. Lerone Bennett Jr. Book Forced Into Glory gets into it deep about Abraham Lincoln's racism. His act of, you know, so-called freeing the slave, which slavery was never abolished. It really wasn't about the humanity of black people. It was to save the Union. And I think, and I know this white writer knows this and is practicing deception and practicing racism in this text. Susan B. Anthony, we know her record. We know her record. So how can we say that, you know, she believed that we should, you know, blacks were, you know, of equal and whatnot. So, I mean, that there's a myriad of these examples of like this, with this right writer interjecting the so-called non-racist good white people, regardless if they have a history of practicing racism or not, even though they probably didn't practice the racism in the form that Edgar Ray Killen did. Nonetheless, they still practice racism. Moving on. Oh, this felt so today-ish. This obviously is a problem that has been going on between victims of, you know, Asian descent and non-white black people. So he goes into the migration of Korean families into Watts was the beginning of the end for the community that was ours. So they sold out to the Koreans coming in. We sold ourselves out. Nobody took anything from us. That's a critical piece of the narrative to understand, because it's easy to forget that we played a part in what happened to our community on that front. VGQ. Racists have a myriad of ways of stalling business progress and making conditions to the extent that they are to make it appealing to sell a business when seem profitable when the opportunity comes. So, you know, VGQ, he's entitled to his opinion about that, but those are just my thoughts. I would just give a little rebuff to that. Like, you know, it's totally our fault. You know, races are directly or indirectly responsible for that. And moving on. Oh, once that was under control, it was time to address the problems that alcohol was bringing to our neighborhoods. People talk about the devastation that illegal drugs bring to places, but I'd argue that alcohol can just be just as much as a game changer. It's just more insidious. I wholeheartedly agree. Alcohol isn't looked at as bad for, you know, obvious reasons. It's legit, you know, government's making money off of it. So, you know, it's not looked at that way. But alcohol does damage. It does damage to community. So, you know, I really appreciate him adding that part in there. Moving on. Yeah, there's a lot about. Here's one more thing. Let me add this. The mix of Korean presence coming in along with the rise of gang violence due to the infiltration into our neighborhoods by the CIA and other forces was a powder keg just waiting to explode. Highlight it. It's by the CIA and other forces. Name those forces. Be direct. You know, we're providing information. Be direct. So, like I said, that's why I said I wouldn't just say, you know, we sold out. You know, racists can, you know, directly and indirectly control circumstances and instances to make and conditions to make you want to sell, or you just make it less of a headache. So that's where I gave pushback, and I just connected that with it. He goes into the, you know, the Latasha Harlan thing, you know, in detail. So I'm going to skip over that. It's a cool text if you want to read, learn a little bit more in depth about that situation and other situations. But, so Mr. Stern, you know, glance through Mr. Stern, he, I guess you would call an activist. He was heavily involved in the community. He had helped broker, you know, a lot of, broker peace between the Korean community and the black community. He worked out something to where, hey, you know, have a black worker there to help the language barrier. So he did some excellent work within the Los Angeles community to, you know, kind of make the community a little bit better. So that, you know, props to him on that. He was very influential in, you know, Koreans and blacks coming to the table to just try to get an understanding. So, you know, these misunderstandings wouldn't keep happening because it just wasn't the Latasha Harlan things. That was thing. It was just, you know, things that were leading up to it, and it just exploded with that situation. Let me see. So, yeah, so at this point, this is where Mr. Stern goes to jail for identity fraud. It becomes something. Oh, metaphors. This is one of those metaphors. When you're thrust into this system of bars and cells, it becomes something that you have to learn to navigate, just as the Korean population had to learn to navigate the culture of South Central. That metaphor, like comparing jail to South Central, you know, where there's a large population of black people, I just kind of, yeah, you know, if you know, it's hard to say if he wrote it or, you know, author that or the white writer wrote it. So, I don't know, VGQ if he did. Those metaphors, you got to watch those metaphors, like Gus says. Okay. Oh, so the next chapter, culture is entitled Culture to Hate. And, you know, I just found some interesting passages. And it goes like this. The reason the culture of hate was at its height in the 1960s because it was being challenged for the first time. Really challenged. I would like to have, you know, someone expand on that because I've known, you know, black people to exhibit counter violence, you know, a lot prior to the 60s. So I would like, you know, that I would like to have had that more explained a little bit better. Moving on. Who knew? Oh, what no one knew was just how deeply rooted the Klan was in their wildest dreams. No one could imagine how entrenched the KKK was in the Sheriff's Department, the Justice Department, all the way up to Congress and the Senate. And that's, you know, the power of the system. I mean, we can look at it. I warn victims of looking at racism at just as the Klan or the Proud Boys or whatever said group. This is a network. This is a global problem, not just, you know, one little group, one little sector, impoverished whites in the trailer park. This thing is major. He said up to the Senate, and you know, you'll see the definite connections and law enforcement and the government, not even local government, but the United States government, how deep this thing really goes. And moving on. So, you know, adding on to the part about the Senate and Congress, it says Killen and his cohorts were completely, totally shielded from any harm. I mean, they were all one. I mean, you know, they were just different on different levels. It's not just his cohorts. Is, you know, they're all one. They're all racist, suspected racist. Not no name calling. Yeah. So next chapter, family ties. It goes into, you know, how deep the Klan was, how like firmly entrenched it was, how it was like religion, so to speak, religion of white supremacy. The Klan wasn't something that was captive to one person. The entire community, whole families were involved in the workings of the Klan in the Deep South. It was understood that a great number of the white folks were members. It's not something someone had to tell you. Ooh, I mean, suspect all. This is why I say just suspect. And if, you know, a white person can prove that they're not a racist, cool. But, you know, it's logical just to suspect. I mean, you just see how it's just expected that everyone was supposed to be a part of the Klan or be racist. It's expected because it's so widespread. So this is why I say, you know, victims should just be on suspect with every person you encounter, especially a white person, a racist suspect. That's where that term comes from. Be suspicious. There's no, just no definite way. But we know that racism is a worldwide global problem. It's been that way for centuries. So it's only logical just to be suspicious. And being suspicious doesn't mean doing anything nefarious, but just being on alert. And, you know, I see a lot of people have trouble with, you know, when I express that, but just kind of hammers home why I have that take. Moving on. This was important. Though he was called preacher, Edgar Ray Killen's actual profession was that of a lumberman. He kept 41 acres of trees on his farm. That's interesting that he would take that that name. And this is why I just tie it back to the religion of white supremacy. Even though he just wasn't your traditional preacher in a church, I think it takes on a different meaning for racists. You know, it takes on a different form than how we process religion or Christianity. It takes a different form for them. And I think we see that when, you know, you call this man a preacher, even though he's an ordained minister. He's the leader of the Klan, and he's leading terrorism throughout the South, especially Mississippi, specifically Mississippi. Yeah, this was important right here. What's important to know right now is that he had a license to buy crate after crate of dynamite and C4 for the purpose of blowing up stumps on his land. This was decades before 9/11, so people didn't think of things in the same way they do now. Anyone who needed to do a bombing for the KKK could just come down and get it from Edgar. I don't think we should have meant, like I said, it's hard to tell. I want to be critical. I knew that the white writer wrote this, I can be much more critical, but you know, it's a little bit confusing being that it was authored by James Howard Stern, but just to be on the safe side, I'll say, you know, do you think a black person could have just, hey, you know, put the same credentials, I own land and I need some dynamite, and they can just get it unlimited crate after crate? I wouldn't think so, especially during those times. There's going to be a limit on it. So to kind of minimize it, just well, he needed it just for his land or for work purposes, is, you know, if it's the victim VGQ, if it's, you know, a white person being deceptive, they're practicing racism. Moving on. Ooh, yeah. The KKK was family, and Killen was their patriarch, the imperial wizard. He used his family business to cover his supplying of explosives for bombings all over the South and Mississippi and everywhere else. That includes the explosives that were used to blow up Martin Luther King Jr.'s home in 1956. Yeah, I mean, Edgar Ray Killen, he was a figure. He was a figure. You know, his dynamite is used. You come see him. You want to blow up Dr. King's house. And if I'm not mistaken, I think the bombing of the church of the four little girls, I believe, he was involved in that some type of way too. Hopefully that'll be in the text, but I believe that's, I believe he's involved in that some way too. Moving on. Oh, so when the civil rights workers were found, there was a trial for some people, and this is how he actually, did he? I don't know, I'll just read the passage. Seven were convicted by all-white jury. Eight were set free. Three got a hung jury. Of the seven men convicted, no one spent longer than 6 years in prison. No all-white jury had ever convicted a government official in a civil rights case until the deputy sheriff was convicted in the Mississippi burning case. The arm of racism, you know, I got these guys in these high places. They'll give me a little slap on the wrist for, you know, murder, terrorism. That's the arm. This is the strength of the system. This is a network. This isn't just, you know, one person or one group. This is a network, a population of people worldwide. And you just see this repeated, you know, these little slaps on. Just look at it today. Just compare this to something that you recently seen in the news. You know, suspected racists getting these little slaps on the wrist for these major offenses. Moving on. So right here we get to Michael Schwerner, Andy Goodman, and James Chaney. See how they put James Chaney at the end of that? That's funny. So they get into, you know, some inside details that I didn't know about. You know, I'm not, you know, totally oblivious to the case, but, you know, I can say I wasn't that informed to, because I missed some of these details. And it goes, in the 6 months that he was in Meridian, Schwerner established a community center for the black population. He organized a boycott against a major variety store in Meridian, forcing it to hire its first black employee. I mean, and this is just, when whites are motivated to do something, they get it done. I mean, how many marches probably in Mississippi during that time and trying to get just the same thing or even less? And, you know, it wasn't accomplished. But, you know, here's, you know, this young white male from up north comes down and just starts getting things done. So when whites are motivated, so if they want to practice justice, they can just do that. They don't need to, you know, be out there marching and holding the signs with you. This is, you know what I mean? They can get things done just quick. And this is just an example of it. If they want to solve this problem, it would have been solved. Moving on. It's important to note that Michael Schwerner was followed by the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. This group was funded by taxpayer dollars and used spies to infiltrate civil rights groups in the South, spying on workers and passing information on to the KKK. There's a documentary called Spies of Mississippi that gets into the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. It's more on the fact of, you know, the non-white victims that were helping the races, you know, do these deeds in Mississippi. So I don't think it should be lost that, you know, now white people help, but don't let that be your focus. It's important to look at it as a tactic of the more powerful people, investigate it, but don't get bogged down on the victims. At the end of the day, they're just victims, and without them, the system is still in place. Even if you didn't have, you know, the helpers, the system is just still in place. And just don't get bogged down on the victims. It's important to note, it's important to develop a strategy against that. Don't get me wrong, but just don't put all your, just focus on the more powerful people who were controlling them, who were paying them. And you will see, if you see the documentary, you will see that, you know, once they were done with them, they were just on their behind, broke, without nothing. And, you know, all you could say, that's why I use the term victim. Moving on. The Jewish, so they're speaking of Nazi Germany being fresh in the mind of Jewish people. The Jewish community rose up to organize and support the civil rights movement in direct reaction to Hitler's slaughter of people. They didn't want these things to happen again. I'm still going on today, so, you know, like I said, no criticism, you know, if that's the black authors, you know, view VTQ, but if the, you know, the white editor or the white writer, you know, you're practicing deception. Yeah, so the next chapter is entitled Core Mount Zion and Grocer's Funeral. And this is just, you know, about terrorism, just racist terrorism. And I'll get into it like this. When someone didn't check in on time, this is a code that, you know, the civil rights workers had, which I think is, you know, seems logical to have. I mean, you're in Mississippi at this time, and it goes as follows. When someone didn't check in on time, the news went straight to the big offices back up north, to the sheriff's department to get things rolling. People were being killed left and right down in Mississippi, and the white racists weren't even close to ready giving up power. I would just say, you know, a code is necessary. That seemed very codified, you know, given what you were dealing with at that time. You know, codes are important. And, you know, that's right on display. So the whole thing escalated quickly when Edgar Ray Killen blew up Mount Zion Church. He was just tired of it. He was tired of these people coming in, messing up his town. He was tired of people not stopping these voter registration drives when they were told to stop. On June 16th, Edgar Ray Killen and his men came down and blew up the church and assaulted several of its members. They were looking for Schwerner. Again, remember, Michael was being followed by the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission. Like I said, if you're not acting correct or upholding your duties as, you know, as a white man, you know, there's repercussions. They can be repercussions. But don't let that fool you to think that the system is in some sort of danger when you have these type of incidents. Let's go. One of Killen's letters detailed exactly how this whole thing's happened. And this is very detailed and, you know, this is accurate information. I mean, it's very direct, which I appreciate. And I hope, you know, the listener can appreciate it too. So, and these are, they're quoting Edgar Ray Killen with this. The nigger was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, speaking of James Chaney. And he took the wrong job. He would have been alive right now if he didn't do it. End of the quote. James Chaney wasn't the target of the Klan's wrath. David Dennis was. Chaney was collateral damage, nothing more than a victim of circumstance. What do you say? So, I guess on the night of, this goes into, you know, a little bit of details of how it all came about, the plan. So prior to them, you know, finding the civil rights workers, they had a funeral for someone in town. And this is what this passage is about. The only funeral parlor in town had an upstairs and downstairs. The whole town had come to pay their respects to the grocer. His memorial is being held upstairs, downstairs in the mortuary. A 9-year-old girl's memorial is being held. She died of a bloodborne pathogen. This is important because it's a central reason why Killen went 40 years without being convicted of the murders. Here's another, I don't know if this is Mr. Hart's assessment or the white writer. And like I've been saying throughout the show, VGQ, if it's Mr. Stern, if it's the white writer, she's practicing racism. That's not the reason for, you know, him being able to escape for 40 years. People, white people knew this information and that he just didn't prosecute him. So, you know, VGQ for Mr. Stern, racist for their white writer or editor. So, going on. So, it says a Klan killing. This is where it kind of gets detailed about the actual murder of James Chaney and the other two guys. The atmosphere, listen to how casual this situation was for them. They just, listen to this. The atmosphere was more one of a party than one of some grim job. While they were out on the back roads of Mississippi, they even stopped for beer twice. Like Gus from the Context of White Supremacy said, whites and alcohol, not a good mix. Not a good mix. And I especially highlighted this. Edgar would always say, all the boys got to do is have beer. They like to be drunk when they do this kind of stuff. Then he let loose with a laugh that made my skin crawl every time. He thought it was the funniest thing ever, heading out to murder these men like there was some kind of deer hunting trip. The psychology, man. Psychology. Someone says on Gus's show, white people kill for fun. This is like a game. Let's get the beer and party it up and, you know, chat it up and let's go do what we want to do. Like the metaphor, hunting deer. This is nothing. Hunting niggers. This is just another sport down here. Whew. There needs to be a study of the psychology of races. Not even the patterns. This is just a consistent pattern. More details. Chaney being put in front. The reason behind this was, listen to this. No black person was ever going to go against a white person. It was something that had been conditioned into people over hundreds of years. They know he wouldn't hit them or try to take a stand, so they felt safe with him there. Think about the terrorism that required for that type of condition. I know you're not going to do nothing. I know it. We conditioned this. We put enough terror and fear in you, your parents, your grandparents. My grandfather, my great-grandfather have put this fear into you to where we know we're not afraid to sit here with you and put you right here because you're not going to do nothing. Imagine that. Took a lot. Moving on. And it says, but Killen and his men reveled in the psychological torture. Yeah, I mean, this should be a study. This reveals a lot, this text. It also says, think of the way a cat plays with the half-dead mouse. Look at the metaphor. Like, black life is worth a mouse. Like, you know, it's the way they treated him. To this day, it's still current. excuse me. Having this kind of power over another human being is a high. It's a horrible, disturbing high. Edgar Ray Killen and his KKK brethren felt like they were in total control at this point, that they were invincible. That's a big reason that they kept on killing. It was about racism and about white people. White people, let me underline that, white people. But it was also about the pure joy, I gotta repeat that, pure joy that took place in these heinous acts. These aren't crimes of passion, they are psychopathic. Oh, I think Dr. Wilson warned against, you know, trying to give it a medical diagnosis. Don't give it an excuse. These people are just racist. These are what racists do. They terrorize, they mistreat. These are the acts of a racist. They're deceitful. So, you know, VGQ, like I said, VGQ, if it's Mr. Stern, and, you know, if it's the white writer or editor, you know, what I've been saying throughout the text. Oh, yeah, listen to, this is more. This is just more, just racist behavior. Edgar cackled every time he saw or heard about the movie Mississippi Burning because he knew that it was far from the truth. These cold-blooded killers were men who had jobs and responsibilities within the community, so one of them had access to a bulldozer. The man who drove the bulldozer was sloppy drunk when it came time to cover up the station wagon. But a night of hard drinking and killing people takes a toll, and the next morning he was so hungover that he forgot all about going back to the job. I mean, like, imagine how comfortable that you have to be to where, you know, I'm going to oversleep after I just murdered someone, have to bury the evidence. But, you know, I'm just so drunk. I'm so irresponsibly drunk. I don't have a fear of getting caught. I overslept and just forgot to do it. I mean, imagine that. It's not funny, but it's like, imagine that. Imagine it. And this is why I say victims of racism. So if I see a person, I mean, I can see that trauma being passed down to where you have the behaviors and pathologies that us as victims have to this day. So, you know, when I see responses to racism, I, you know, try to keep my emotions in check and not keep my anti-blackness down, because I know the terror is on full display. And this is just a time period. This has been going on for centuries prior to this. So, you know, this is just why I say victims of racism. Victims of racism. Oh, the next chapter is entitled An Awakening for the Klan in Mississippi. Now, this just reveals a lot. We've been killing a good nigger forever. It's like killing one of my dogs or cats. No big deal. What Edgar didn't understand was that he crossed an important line by killing Goodman and Schwerner. The Jewish community is tight-knit and afraid. This is Mr. Stern, VGQ. This is the white writer. More racism. It's not that the Jewish community were tight, because had these been black Jews, the same response would have been given to the rest of the black people that were killed. The fact that it got all its attention because they were white, that's the real reason. And to leave that out, like I said, you know, VGQ to Mr. Stern, no critique of him. But like I said, this is the danger of having white writers, white editors, because they can inject something that reflects the views of, you know, the black author. So, but like I said, if, you know, VGQ to Mr. Stern, other than that, full on racism with that passage and many other stuff in here. Also, this underlines it even more. When black folks went missing, nothing ever came of it. They just disappeared. Killen was so full of himself about his power over life and death by this point that it didn't even occur to him that anyone was going to come after them for killing anyone in that area. Like I said before, he really thought he had the power of the Grim Reaper, choosing life and death. Also, unlike what happened with the black folks when these two Jewish men, just say white, two Jewish men didn't check in and follow protocol, immediate action was taken by the New York white Jewish community. That's more accurate. They made calls to the sheriff's office there in Mississippi. The sheriff was, of course, colluding with the KKK and flat out lied about it. When the people from up in New York called, the sheriff told the investigators they never came. They probably ran home and right now having a good laugh at you guys. They're still in New York. They never came to Mississippi. And like, this is just an example of whites mistreating the other whites, just based off the practice of how we deal with niggers, how we deal with our inferiors. This isn't, you know, the system is firmly in place. These two are just going through a little disagreement, and not little, but it for them it's little, because the mission is still in place. The whole objective is still in place. It's just we're disagreeing on practices. And I think that's important that we highlight that. Moving on. The sheriff's office covered their tracks well and kept up their denials. But again, this wasn't like killing black people. Right now we're getting more accurate. But again, this wasn't like killing black people in the South. And that's why I said, you know, white And I don't, you know, compare a religion to a classification of people, because it's not, you know, it's not the same. And, you know, there can be confusion. It's not direct. So here it is. Here, there's another comparison. There's another important distinction between the Jewish community, and it should be the Jewish white community and the black community. The Jewish community had the pull and connections in high places. It's not because they're Jewish, it's because they're white. I mean, it's burning me up reading it. I have to interject. They started reaching out to anyone they thought might be able to help. Eventually, all getting all the way up to President Lyndon B. Johnson himself. You know, no black person is doing it. It's not because they're Jewish. It's because that they're white. They were able to get to Lyndon B. Johnson himself. Johnson went to Senator James Eastland of Mississippi. This is very, you know, follow these names because, you know, he'll learn a connection and see how powerful, you know, this the arm really is, how deep this thing really went. Senator James Eastland of Mississippi, a powerful foe of integration in the South and a KKK collaborator. They didn't say KKK member or collaborator. This man can easily just, hey, no, I'm not a member of the KKK, even though he shares the views. So this is why I resent people just putting racism on a group or an organization, on a white organization. No, you can be an individual in a collection. And so I just resent tying racism to an organization or a group of racists. And, you know, that's just on display with this. He's just a collaborator of the KKK. But what would have been more accurate, he's a collaborator and a believer in a system of white supremacy. He's a racist. I mean, that's what it is. But for the sake of name calling, suspected racist. This is just highlighting different philosophies of going about practicing racism. Many people in the Klan in the South were many people in the Klan in the South were virulent about the Jews for the same reason that Jews were so passionate about helping the civil rights movement. Were they passionate or were they using refined racist tactics? I mean, that's something that, you know, we should keep in mind and, you know, ask ourselves in our research and our studies. What does, you know, being passionate about something look like? But like I said, let's move on. Turn my page in my notes. Oh, so the conviction of Mr. Killen, this is where we are, Killen's conviction. And what I would like to put in the minds of the people to think about and think logically about is the conviction of Mr. Killen of these killings came off as progressive and were becoming a utopia of a racial recognition, whatever words they choose to use, the whatever tacky words that they or phrases that they choose to use. This wasn't that. This was an act of refinement to confuse victims, to say, hey, we're getting better And unfortunately, these tactics work and they're still being practiced today. So I think it's important that, you know, we look at the conduct of, you know, we're still in the system. He's a white sacrifice for, you know, for the system. So it shouldn't be confused with this is justice or we're moving forward to solving this problem based off, you know, a conviction or two. So moving on. Think back to earlier. You'll remember that the jury was hung because one woman said that she couldn't vote for a preacher to be convicted. Even though, like, the racist code, even though he wasn't, you know, physically in a church preaching, like I said, that term, religion, means something different to racists. And you see that right here. He's not a, you know, a T.D. Jakes or Joel Osteen in the church preaching, and, you know, you can't convict him. This dude, he just is an ordained minister practicing racism in Mississippi. There, you know, but the religion of white supremacy, this is why I put that in the beginning. The KKK was so entrenched in the government that it took a Herculean effort on the part of Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy to bring the men to trial at all. the power. This isn't, like I said, this just, you know, it is deep. I mean, it's really deep. We think of the Klan as these toothless hillbillies and hicks and, you know, can't read incest bread and all the stuff like that. But if you just look at the patterns, look at the history, these, you know, they are in the government. They are, like, sophisticated. They're refined now. So I just challenge the way that people, you know, if you have that traditional way of thinking about, you know, Klan or racism, that, you know, you update your definition or look at it a little from a different perspective and update your understanding on it. Moving on. Federal officials had dismissed the charges, so a federal prosecutor had to get a grand jury to even get the men in court. It wasn't until 2005 that Edgar Ray Killen was brought to justice. The story of how he got to be arrested is a winding one. Yeah, listen to how he got arrested. An investigative reporter for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi, Jerry Mitchell, spent 6 years digging through the case and writing about it. A high school teacher from Chicago and his students collaborated with Mitchell, and the students reached out to Killen for an interview. Unbelievably, he agreed. And look at it, he had to basically, you know, turn himself in. I mean, this is well-known knowledge. They just couldn't let you go. So it's not like, you know, they did, you know, great police work and, you know, years later they solved the cold case. He basically confessed, told on himself. You had to come get him. You didn't have to, but they did. Moving on. So this is more about 1389. This is more about Mr. Stearns, how he became incarcerated. He was really railroaded. Let me get into that. During the first 2 weeks following my arrest, this is Mr. Stern here, all of the federal agencies determined that I was not guilty. That's important to understand because I wasn't the only person that they were looking for. I had been the victim of identity theft. All the agencies dropped those charges against me except the state of Mississippi. By the time I stood in that courtroom, I had no idea why I was there, and neither did the judge. Think about that. The judge didn't even, you know, what is he doing here? What? The FBI dropped the case, and, you know, there's direct evidence saying that, you know, he's not innocent, but, and he filed paperwork to, you know, get out and plead his case, but it says the clerk had never filed my motion, and that's a serious violation of the law. And like I said, system of white supremacy, it's not, you know, one person, one group, one entity. It takes a collective effort. So you never know. Look at this, just the clerk in the local courthouse just didn't file a motion and, you know, assisted in the railroading. So this is why I say just suspect all until proven otherwise. It's nothing. It's just totally logical to do that. You have this system that's been going on for as long as it has and how entrenched and deep it is. Listen to the conditions. He had to get a haircut in prison. Listen to this. one after another, men sat down and had their hair shorn. It says shorn off. Maybe should be shaved off. With these same electric blades. Blades that you could see the blood on in places. It didn't matter to them that deadly diseases were sitting on those blades or that the people wielding them were unlicensed barbers, which is illegal in Mississippi. This is prison. I believe is in Parchment. Notorious prison in Mississippi, worldwide, probably nationwide at minimum. We don't care. We don't care about the cloniness or the sanitary conditions of in prison. You're a nigger. You're a nigger in prison. So, you know, yeah, get this hepatitis. Get these HIV-filled blades and whatnot. Yeah, we don't care. It's the law. We make the law. Continuing on. He talks about his experiences navigating prison and, yeah, Parchment. I was correct. In August of 2010, I was put in a prison cell at the Mississippi State Penitentiary at Parchment. The Mississippi Department of Corrections took all my medications away from me in retribution for my letter writing campaign. Let me just stop right there. Black self-respect. He kept fighting. He, you know, filed continuous motions and he dealt with, you know, the terrorism that came with that. He knew he was innocent. Anyway, they took my eye drops and glaucoma medications, which pushed the pressure in my eyes sky high and caused my eyes to begin to swell. Glaucoma is manageable when treated with modern medication, but without proper treatment, it's a nightmare. I started losing my vision in my left eye very quickly once the medications were taken away, and my right eye started becoming increasingly blurry with each passing day. The facility I was housed in initially was a huge dormitory. Imagine a huge warehouse with 100 beds, no windows, no ventilation inside. This warehouse lives hundreds of men cramped in on top of one another. Smoking is rampant in the prison, and the men smoke like chimneys, one cigarette after another, all day, all night. Secondhand smoke is gnarly stuff, no matter who you are, but it was especially devastating to my glaucoma-ridden eyes. My eyes were in constant pain from the smoke, swelling and swelling as the pressure continued to rise. Eventually, my left eye protruding from its socket, bulging and agonizingly throbbing. As this went on, discharge started to come up from my eye. I'm just going to pause. This is, you know, you fight against us. You know, we know you're innocent, but we want you. We're white and we say so, and you're going to come into prison and see if you can get your way out. And while you're here, don't think you're going to get any humane treatment. I mean, you're a nigger for God's sake. Take his medicine and put him in this unsanitary dorm with, you know, unlicensed barbers with blood and all types of other bodily fluids and cutting, not sanitizing the clippers. Put him in here where they're smoking like chimneys and his medical conditions are just going to flare up. Who cares? He's a nigger. So, the system, this is just how, you know, you don't have to say it. Their actions demonstrate it. Okay, continuing on. Upon my arrival, I was ordered to Unit 31. This was supposed to be a medical facility, and it was certainly that was kept secluded from every other yard on the field. The men in this unit were the worst of the worst in Mississippi. The vilest humans from a whole state slopped together. Every man in this block was put there intentionally. There were no mistakes placement in Unit 31. I mean, yeah, we're going to make this, you know, your worst experience here. And I mean, this is just isn't unique to Mississippi. You know, look at Mumia Abu-Jamal. Just look at him today. I mean, the same, you know. Different states, same set of circumstances. You know, you hear about, you know, blacks being experiments and, you know, mistreat. I mean, it's just prevalent. This isn't anything unique to just Mississippi or the South. But, so this is when he met Mrs. Egeray Killen, I guess, in this unit for the medical unit in the prison. and it's entitled Nigger Stern. He finally smiled, rolled his wheelchair, and said, "Oh, you damn nigger," then just rolled on out of the room, pissed as hell. He was hot as has on fire mad. I remember Larry Merritt and some other white guys saying, "What a fool I was. You shouldn't have done that. That's Edgar Ray killing. You don't know what you just did," pissing him off. While this is happening, I'm thinking to myself, what did I do? I just smiled at him. So what he's referring to is, you know, Killen was trying to get his attention when he was in the medical unit, and he was, you know, calling him nigger and, you know, monkey, whatever, any type of name, and he wouldn't respond to him. And eventually Killen got upset and just rolled off calling him a damn nigger, and he smiled at him. So this is what they're referring. That's what that passage is referring to. Oh, we Johnny Cochran, he's a legend. So in the next chapter entitled Bag of Mail, Mr. Stern, you know, was, you know, doing constructive work, trying to get out of greater confinement. And he earned the name Johnny Cochran, the legend, Johnny Cochran, the legend. I mean, excellent work against racism. Continuing on. Oh, this is more describing about, you know, his initial meetings with Killen. Even though I gotten to the point where I could laugh at his insanity, I was a stalwart as ever in my resistance against racism. This man won't get away with this. My eyes rose to meet his as I spoke with clarity, purpose, and focus. Edgar Ray Killen, you done called me everything but a black man for the past 3 days and anything but a child of God. And you have an unmitigated gall to ask me to help you with your legal work without missing the beat. Edgar looked at me in my eyes and spit out, "You damn straight, nigger. Read that shit." I appreciate my racist up and direct. The refined ones are the most dangerous ones and appear to be the most powerful ones at this point. I like it straight up and direct. I mean, here, like Killen said, read this. You damn right, nigga. Read it. Help me with my legal work. And, you know, I like my races up front. I like to know exactly who you are. Let's just move on. When you understand an evil, you got a much better chance to disempower that evil. That's exactly what I was setting out to do. I want to understand this man so that I could take his power away from him. When you really want to know someone in prison, the best way to learn about them is through their legal mail. So in service of my understanding of Edgar Ray Killen, I agreed to read his stuff for him. These papers would tell me everything that I needed to know on a level that was more in depth than any conversation I could ever have with that man. BGQ, I mean, I think he did his sacrifice and tolerating that, you know, type of treatment, presented us with this text that will help us further understand the system. So, you know, I'm appreciative for that sacrifice and tolerating that type of treatment to, you know, do something constructive with it, you know, once he was released. Okay. Oh, yeah. So this is about Mr. Stern reading his mail. As I was reading, my jaw dropped to my ankles and my head started spinning. I could not fathom what the hell I'd done to get placed into a room with this man. How could my life have possibly led me here? This was the kind of man you read about in your history books at school, a relic from a time that we all thought was living behind us, even though if we are still living with the consequences of it. And this is why I say we don't understand racism. We think it's just something from the past. These people are still walking amongst us, even though they're very old and they have passed that on. They're just more refined. And, you know, this is why I said information is key. We need information before we can, you know, put together, you know, these organizations. Information is what's lacking. That's what I've determined. Unfortunately, information is lacking. And, you know, Mr. Stern just admitted how, you know, how he thought this was just something in the history book, somebody he never come in contact with. So, like I said, suspect everyone till proven otherwise. That's just my code. Let's see. Remember Senator James Eastland from before. Senator James Eastland's name began to show up in documents. He was a man whose name I was unfamiliar with, but he was a United States Senator. Then I saw President Lyndon B. Johnson's name. This is the reach. This is the reach. So, you know, when you're sitting up, so you wonder why, you know, law enforcement is the way it is. They're just protecting, you know, just they're enforcing the law of the system that we currently have. So, you know, the battle with the police is, you know, it's bigger than that. It's bigger than that. As you can see, this thing goes up to the president of the United States, a so-called top spot in the world, one of the top spots in the world. So, you know, information is lacking, and I just hope this provided a lot of information. It just reaffirmed what a lot of what I thought about the system. After I read everything he'd given me, dug through his history and the reality to his court battles, I handed him back his papers, told him what the absolute truth about what I read. Well, Edgar, I don't know who wrote this for you, but whoever wrote this for you, they don't plan on you ever getting out of prison. They did a bunch of legal mumble jumble, a lot of words, but not one of it makes sense. Ways that whites practice racism. Words, words, words. They give you a word salad. They sanitize words. The double speak. This is just me talking now. This is ways that they practice, you know, racism, and they're doing it to further the system of white supremacy by locking up this white sacrifice and killing. Let me get back to illegal. Not one of it makes sense. This is just some lawyer doing his duty enough to say that he done something for you, but it's not reading any direction to you getting out of jail. Edgar was never a man who took long to process information. This was a man with the confidence of a demagogue. He looked right up at me and responded, "Oh, you damn nigga, I thought so." He threw the papers at me. I mean, imagine that. You know, you're trying to help this racist and, you know, constantly disrespecting you, nigger, and throwing paper at you and read it, talking to you in your kind of way. Just imagine living like that. You know, like I said, I don't, you know, this is the more explicit racist. The refined ones are just way more refined, but, you know, way more effective. And I think, like, he alluded to Mr. Killen processing information quick, so he wasn't some feeble old senile old man just, you know, running off. What else did I want to, yeah, doesn't matter. I'm moving on. People told me that he had judges, senators, and congressmen in his back pocket because they were all Klansmen. Yeah, I mean, you have all these powerful people, and you somehow end up in prison. I mean, it's obviously you're just a white sacrifice for, you know, the army of white supremacy, for the system to keep going and throw more confusion. And, you know, that's just reiterated throughout this text. Yeah, in today's world, no self-respecting government official would ever admit involvement with the Klan. I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, deeds are important. Seeing is, you know, better than, you know, talk. So, you know, so I guess he became a caregiver cellmate. That's what the chapter is. When I was moved into the cell block with Edgar Ray Killen, he was a man that had been just allowed to live in his own super body fluids for months. Look at that. And, you know, they'll talk about superior and inferior, but, you know, you got this outright racist, not bathing, sitting in his own stuff, missing teeth, in prison, you know, in deplorable conditions. But, you know, they have this superior mentality. I mean, you know, that whiteness means something, you know, regardless of where I am and regardless of whatever condition I am, I'm still, you know, a study of the white mind is very necessary. Information's needed. This is why I like my racism direct. You know, I don't like the sugarcoat. I don't want to, you know, read through the lines, read between the lines, so to speak. Moving on. I'm just going to tell it like this. The man stink when I first seen him. It wafted off of him, and it was inescapable. This is how I came to bathe Edgar Ray Killen. VGQ. I think this story would appeal to a lot of suspected racists also, because it shows, you know, a black man so-called turning the other cheek, being the bigger guy, you know, accepting, not stooping down to the race of not responding. And I think, you know, racists and suspected racists love that response to racism in that fashion. So I can see why, you know, they would like this text, along with, you know, the so-called, you know, Abraham Lincolns and Heather Hares and Susan B. Anthony's references. So, you know, they go into him actually going in there bathing him, you know, which is, you know, not important. Here's one thing. I cannot overstate the distaste that people harbor for Edgar Ray Killen in Unit 31. He was revered in a way that I did not know was possible for a man to be revered. With that, he was also disliked vehemently. The black inmates urinated in his coffee and put human feces in his food. Hey, you know, you're in prison, buddy. Greater confinement. These guys been around for a while. And when you're in prison, you got nothing to do but time to think. They had seriously thought thoroughly about how to hide human waste in this man's food as some form of retribution. Let's just look at that. This man has, you know, dozens of murders and bombings underneath his belt. He actually put in some work for the system of white supremacy. And the only retribution he can get is, you know, putting feces in food. I mean, that's no small thing, but it's nothing in comparison to, you know, really putting that work in and taking lives and, you know, hobnobbing with senators and getting things done, installing terrorism throughout Mississippi and the South and the world. I mean, that, you know, it's not really in comparison. So this is why, you know, our response has, you know, we need a better effective response, you know, in my opinion. But VGQ, you know, you do what you can do, I guess, in that situation. No critique of the non-white victims. The whole thing is that the same power dynamic we keep talking about, their desperation for justice has transformed into determination, and now they were acting on it. They were counting on Edgar Ray eating that shit and drink that piss. The officers and other inmates came down to our unit to see the show. And make a long story short without reading all this. So basically, Mr. Stern, you know, saves them, stops them from eating it, and it causes conflict with other inmates, especially the black ones. And, you know, yeah, he stopped them, and this is important. Listen to this. He stopped them. He stopped them from eating it, and let's listen to Edgar Ray's response when Mr. Stern tells him that, you know, why he shouldn't eat it. Edgar said, "Motherfucking damn niggers, I stopped them there. Hold on, Edgar. There's an error within this text, so I can't read it straight. I'm going to make them stop it now. I'm just going to paraphrase. I'm trying to help you. Cool it with the names. I grabbed Edgar's plate and cup and walked past the inmates right through them. I wasn't even thinking at the time." Yeah, this is, his response was, you know, "You damn niggers, but you got a so-called nigger helping you out." So, you know, that, you know, the irony of it. So he got into it with with a black inmate and wound up being assaulted, which, you know, the prison guards knew this was coming. The white prison guards, this is just the way they run it. Their system, their greater confinement system. He ended up getting beat, and, you know, the officers came down to take a report, and, you know, he declined the report because he knew, you know, that would be classified as snitching, and that was pretty much the kiss of death when you're in greater confinement. So, oh, yeah, this is where I thought I was. Listen to Edgar Ray's assessment of the whole situation of Stern going against the black inmates for the betterment of him not eating feces and urine. Edgar Ray Killen was, it's called wolf booty, so when you hear it, that's what it is. Edgar Ray Killen was eating his wolf booty and laughing. The old man's eye lifted to meet mine and said, "You know, boy, let me tell you something. At the end of the day, white folks always stick together. Niggers always go against each other. It was like getting slapped in the face. I just protected this man, and here he was still spouting that racist bullcrap to me. All I wanted to do was go over there and smack the fool right out of his hand." Like I said, it's an understanding. What does it mean to be white? What is racism? Accurate, logical definitions and information will help understand. It wouldn't create the, "Wow, I'm surprised that he's still doing, like, what does it mean?" Assess your definition. Assess, is it logical? What does this mean? And, you know, he's like hurt or shocked that this man is still, you know, practicing racism in the form that he's doing it. So, moving on. So I guess after that, you know, he said that Killen became more comfortable with him. He started to open up with him. And, you know, he believed that he actually started to like him. You know, VGQ, you know, what does it mean to be white? What is a racist? You know, this goes into, you know, the beating. You know, he's beaten severely. Oh, yeah. So when he got back to his cell after, you know, the beating, listen to, you know, Killen is still him. Edgar Ray Killen is still him. When I walked back into my cell, I remember Edgar looking at me. The mold on his face was totally unlike anything I've ever seen. An unfathomable mix of compassion and anguish. This man, the notorious racist and perpetrator of unspeakable crimes, had a tear in his eye for a black man. It was kind of laughable with that. Like, he's really, you know, and sad in this murder. Edgar said, "James," but I responded before he could say anything else, "Shut up, Edgar. Shut up, or I'll come over there and whoop your ass myself. I just got beat up behind your ass, so shut up." Killen shook his head and said, "Damn niggers," and turned his wheelchair around and rolled the other way. I mean, I don't know how much I could have, you know, tolerated, you know, the... But, you know, for the sake of this text and the information that was put out there, it was, you know, it was for a good cause, so to speak. It provided, you know, a constructive result. But I don't know how much I could have tolerated of that. Moving on to the next chapter. Oh, this just shows the arm of racism. This just is another example of how connected it is. The next day, we receive an unexpected visit from a lieutenant, internal... affairs, John Rogers. I love the names. He walked over to Edgar first and gave three taps to his waistband with a V sign. This was the symbol of the KKK. Edgar returned with a Hail Hitler gesture as acknowledgement, recognizing that he had been acknowledged. Edgar turned and looked at me laughing. "You didn't know we were everywhere, did you?" Man, I mean, make it plain. John Rogers walked over to me. Yeah, this is just when he declined to tell the authorities what had happened to him. And so I guess Edgar, like I said, this is the refinement, and he sees that, you know, this nigga is, you know, pretty sharp. He can probably help me get out of jail. So he's trying to refine it, you know, as much as he can. If you can, say that. So, so it's written that my decision to tell him the truth ended up being the thing that was the basis of our relationship. No one had ever had the gumption to tell him the truth before, and he respected me for that. He didn't like me, but he respected me. VGQ. The first letter that Edgar Ray Killen ever wrote to me was centered on that idea of respect. Before I go home to be with God, it is because you are a Christian that I am willing to talk to you about your battle against Attorney General Hood. Like, stop it. You know, because you're a Christian and I'm a Christian. Stop it. You practice. Your religion is white supremacy. Stop it. You may think, like, this is all the refinement. You may think it's strange for me to give my final statements to a black man such as you, but it's the right thing to do on so many levels, being KKK. Take care of yourself, young man, and live your life to the fullest. Forever your friend, Edgar Ray Killen. He wrote him a letter, like, stop it. This is just refinement. He has his, like, he's clearly still has that same mind frame from when he was, you know, reigning terror on the streets of Mississippi. And this just shows that even the hardcore, you know, racists, the white extremists, so to speak, the most extreme forms of racism, they attempt to how deceptive they can be and how trusting we can get of them, you know, when they seemingly changed a bit. So, like, I leave out the question, what does it mean to be white? What does it mean to be racist? Deception is a major tool in the system of racism. So, you know, he's just practicing deception to further his gains. Let me try to speed up a bit. Very detailed book. Took extensive notes. Yeah, Edgar Ray saw me as a friend. That's not because of any friendliness that I showed to him, but rather it was because I was not negative to him. I mean, VGQ, no. Yeah, so he's describing what, you know, he thinks that made Edgar Ray open up, which can totally be true. To be isolated in an already isolating place is nearly unbearable. It's something that Edgar Ray Killen felt keenly in Unit 31, and it was that sense of isolation that ultimately drove him to open up to me. You crave human interaction when you're deprived of your freedom. It is the most powerful drug, you know, I can imagine. So, you know, that may be may have been a catalyst for his refinement of racism, but, you know, racism was the core centering idea between his ideology. Okay, so he starts getting into, you know, his past crimes. Dead men tell no tales. One of the things that Edgar Killen wanted most out of our relationship was for me to offer up my support for his legal defense. So he's not ignorant about, you know, his ulterior motives. You know, my first, this is Killen talking. You know, my first lawyer was Mitch Moran. I killed him. I was utterly blown away by this revelation. I met Edgar's eyes with a horrified look on my face. Huh? Edgar met my gaze and kept on going. I killed him. He broke the code. Stern. Mitch Moran lost my case, so he had to die. So I told his wife, poison that motherfucker tonight and have his body burned the next day. I mean, he broke the code. I mean, like I said, if you're not acting correct as a white man, you will get in trouble. And sometimes, you know, meet your demise. As I said before, most of my time with the man was spent in silence. He needed someone to talk to, someone to vent to about everything that he had going on in his head. Human beings are social creatures, and we need to talk to other people or else we'll go straight crazy. So the next chapter, entitled Jackson, Mississippi. So he gets into his crimes. George was a striking example of how things change. I think about him in parallel to Edgar Ray Killen because there's a lot of truth and contrast. At the height of his power, Edgar was untouchable. He could commit any act, perpetrate any crime, and indulge in every impetus of hate that swelled up in his vitriolic little mind. He was the one beyond reproach then, and one protected by his station. Time and social movements had quelled that protection, though, and now he was the vulnerable one on the other side. Oh, he's comparing George Jackson to Edgar Ray Killen. No compare VGQ. No critique of, you know, Mr. Stern. He's comparing George Jackson, you know, there he's holding him on the cell. Two different things. I'll just skip that, you know. You can get the text if you want to get into that. Oh, George Jackson, not the infamous George, but there's a George Jackson in the prison who, you know, wielded some power. So let me just clear that up. So George, that George, he was this George Jackson. He put it into the mind of Stern to have Killen write everything down because he knew that no one would believe, you know, all these stories. Or and you can't, you know, your memory is not all that good, so. He gave him the idea, and he goes into what, you know, George did to get in prison. You know, he did a heinous act. I mean, victim. He is a victim. So he goes in. I showed the first letter to George Jackson, who was quite profound of himself, and rightly so. He beamed when he told me, oh, we got his ass. We got him. He wrote you a letter and signed it. Get him to write everything down. I told George that I was going to be hard to make happen, but George encouraged me because he knew that this was critically important in creating a record of these heinous acts. It's like I said, United Independent, just doing something constructive. You know, thanks George for even giving him the idea of, you know, doing this, because it produced this great work that we have. You know, United Independent. Constructive activities. So this is what Killen was saying to Mr. Stern. James, let me say this, and don't you ever forget it. I will never turn my back on you, nor will any Klan member ever harm you for your honest efforts and you are trying to do for me in the media. There cannot be a dollar value placed on what you are doing, as your support for me brings sorrow and troubles on you, James. You are a brave man and a true friend. I'm proud to call you a friend. A friend. But, you know, as soon as he gets you, nigger this, you know, you stupid nigger, like, yeah, what a friend. Where am I at? Of everything that had thrown Edgar Ray Killen and I together, the most powerful connection that we share that was VGQ. Of everything that had thrown Edgar Ray Killen and I together, the most powerful connection that we shared was that of our faith. Though he and I couldn't see eye to eye almost anything when it came to how to live life, we both served as preachers. Like I said, you know, more understanding is needed about the system. I mean, that just seems like a little bit of confusion. No critique of the victim. VGQ. In June... He wrote this letter in June 2010, after living in a God-hating state prison. I filed many appeals to the captain, go to the free world. Of course, it was really about mistreatment. I'm just scrolling through this. And he's just talking about how he met James Stern, and they're both born again Christians like me, and he's a good man, and we're a friend. Nonsense. It's not refinement. It's really refinement. This is a good example of how, you know, the most hardcore racists can refine their ideology to get what they need or better practice racism. This is the next chapter entitled The Odd Couple. I never opened up much about who I was to Edgar, but I knew better to allow myself to be vulnerable to this man. But he opened up to me a great deal. So he did, you know, he wasn't totally confused about racism, you know, like we, you know, we all are confused on some level. You know, he didn't, you know, he knew better. So, which is great. This was the only, so he's talking about, you know, how often he watched Fox News because it wasn't Jewish owned and, you know, well, Fox is turn it on right now. You'll probably see why, Killen is still watching it. Well, he used to watch it. That was his favorite news source. Yeah, he knew this. That matters because Edgar Rivers was just reinforcing those thoughts that he had in his nearly 90 years on this planet. He never really been challenged, yeah. Oh, this is, you know, next chapter entitled Baby Doll, The Importance of White Women in the System. His white wife is a participant in the terrorism. We generally give white women a pass. We'll talk about patriarchy and, you know, the white man and men, period, but can't have a system of racism without white women. Listen to this. I know that she is not clean in all the things that happened in Mississippi, and it's a little known fact that women were incredibly heavily involved in the workings and crimes of the KKK. That's something that I didn't understand until I lived with Edgar Ray Killen. This just hammer homes my point of studying racist, suspected rape. It requires more study. It took him to live with, you know, admitted racist to learn these things, to be suspicious of white women and learn their role. And, you know, I just try to, you know, learn from, you know, situations like that and use counter-racist logic. This just, you know, just really fulfilling for me. It's just reaffirming that. So this is Killen, you know. I didn't take part in those three killings of bitches in 1964. I did take part in the killing of those three sons of bitches in 1964. Those communist bastards got what they had coming. Use my name and the trigger man's name I gave you. But remember, his powerful family will retaliate. I mean, he's letting them know. I mean, you can drop the guy's name, but they're powerful. These are powerful races. These aren't, you know, your backwood hillbillies and people that you just see. These are people. These are real powerful people. What does it mean to be white? What is the system of racism? Information is lacking. Information is much needed. Since the law prohibits me from profiting from my story, I'd rather get nothing before I let the families of those bastards receive one red nickel. My state I love has fucked us over so much, old school style. This is what Killen is talking about, Mississippi. You know, he's bitter about, you know, being locked up, being screwed over. I mean, he's been free for freaking, 40, 50 years after committing various dozens of murders. I mean, but, you know. Let me go back. So my state I love has fucked us over old school style. I'm an expert at doing that. I practiced law years without licensing, representing black poor bastards. I'll admit to the 1964 case and drop all pills and something that they hadn't expected. I'll plead no contest to, listen to this, 32 cold cases I'm sure they expect I'm involved in. It's not funny, but the depths of, you know, the brashness of, you know, they know I did this. They're not coming. They suspect it, but they're not going to, you know, do some true investigative police work. You know, I'm white in a system of racism. What does it mean? What does that information is lacking overall about this system? And I just keep reiterating that because of just some discussions I had, you know, with the victim of racism. And, you know, I'm just trying to explain, you know, how much information is not known. And it's just, you know, just keep reiterating it. So, excuse me if I'm putting emphasis on it and you already understand the importance of it. But there's some that don't. Let me get back. And, yeah, practicing law. Like, they're just, you know, locking up black people wholesale, probably taking their money, sending them to prison. You know, practicing right, mistreatment. Like, I define my mistreatment, locking them up, old school practice of racism, locking up niggers. It's easy for people to look at someone like Edgar Ray Killen and see nothing but his hate and his crimes. But the bottom line is that every single one of us, every single person, has some light of goodness. VGQ. Both Edgar Ray Killen and Betty Jo had crossed into horrendous acts that were motivated by racist hatred. It is what it is. Can't have a system of racism without white women, period. The man. When he signed over his rights and assets to me, it was because he was looking at the bigger picture to accomplish his goals. Like I said, he understood this dude had an ulterior motive, so like I said, it's hard to actually, you can't speak to Mr. Stern because unfortunately he passed away. So it's hard to really tell what's him when it especially was written by, a white woman, and you have more than likely a white editor. It's hard to really tell what's his words and what's not. Everyone around Edgar Ray changed at some point as the Klan began to wane in popularity and power throughout his lifetime. We just say they refined. I mean, they got away from the more explicit, direct forms of racism and just refined themselves. Hands down, the most shocking thing that Edgar Ray confessed to me was that he was part of many, many more murders than had ever been revealed to the public. Because I am the kind of man and minister of God that will take people's secrets, confessions to my grave when they confide in me in confidence. Yes, I could make lots of money and get release if I tell all I know. I cannot. I am loyal to my oath to God. The trigger man of the 1964 killings is my greatest example of my ability to hold a confidence. This was a deathbed confession. Like I said, dedication to the system of racism, dedication to the end, dedicated. I don't think we know. I don't think we know how insidious, how entrenched, how deep this thing really goes. We look at it on a surface level, and that's why, deceptive language and, sanitizing of language and not being as direct as possible, it's dangerous because there's already a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding. We need as much direct information and language as possible. So this is why, I point out, and other counter-racists point out, deceptive language, because it's a major, major act. I'm trying to gain understanding here. While death is a tragedy, the deaths of those three men saved the lives of thousands of white women from rape from black men who were misled, and I am confident that the majority of Mississippians would agree if they knew that the mission of those two Jews and the black man was just their driver. Wrong place, wrong time, wrong job he took. I would like to just see the evidence of, they say, just want to rape. Like, what evidence do you have? It's just something that just comes out of thin air, like that this raping thing. Like Dr. Wilson said, fear of genetic annihilation. What you have to understand about Edgar Ray Killen is that he genuinely believed in his heart of hearts that black folks were not only inferior, but they were dangerous. Like my racism direct. Yes. Give it to me straight. Here it is. Oh, here's another just highlight of, the disrespect. I'll say his full name so your nigger brain won't think I'm talking about you. Oh, he was talking about somebody named James. And, he wrote, I'll say his full name because so your nigger brain won't think I'm talking about you, James Ford Seale. That was my dear friend, later joined the police force to carry on the cause. I'll tell you more about that later. You're going to eventually hate me, but the killing of those two niggers was gratifying. the sons of bitches. I don't know if I'll ever get over the coldness which Edgar Ray talked about black people or Jewish people for that matter. Like I said, I like my racism straight and direct. I know a lot of people like the sanitized version, but I believe that leads to more confusion. Straight and direct. I want to clear my baby doll. Had nothing to do with these killings. She only sent me the names at my request. I had stored at home. James, when you leave, this should assure the stale giving me medical release. My confession to personally killing Jesse Brown, Vincent Diamond, Roman Duckworth, Clifton Walker, Donald Raspberry, Wireless Jackson, Booker Mixon, and Ed Smith. There's more. I'll tell you that we already got in trouble using the phone to get these names from baby doll. I mean, a laundry list of just of victims of black males killed. Just a laundry list. There's plenty of them. Niggas for days. And I got some more. Like, man, to read this. I'm really at a loss for words, if you could tell, man. The media and others brought the name to my attention. I personally exercise justice. You call it murder. Wow. Johnny Queen, Lamar Smith, Paul Gillard, Clifton Walker. As I once mentioned, James just knew too much. Salem Tiggs, Sylvester Maxwell, Clinton Melton, Jimmy Griffin. My ability to carry out justice as God's preacher was never questioned about these acts of justice. Niggers' intention to rape white women was a hatch plan from the Jews. The non-mentality of the Negro was made it easy on the Jews. I mean, Edgar Ray killing. And I just lost my spot. Edgar Ray killing. Notorious, 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 notorious. I lost my spot. Please forgive me. Come on. Yeah, it goes into, I'm sorry, just try not to go past my point. Yeah, okay, I'm here. Yep. Yeah, okay, we're back. Apologize for that. It was striking to me that Edgar remembered clearly the names of these men and the events surrounding each of the murders. They were crystal clear to him. They stayed with him for decades, just as their families continue to mourn the loss of their lives. So too did Edgar Ray Killen continue to believe in his justifications in killing them. Ah, man, listen to this. I pray God has forgiven me for all my past, receive me in his kingdom. But I admit to all have been convicted of the 1964 killings and the 32 others I personally had a part in killing. Those communist niggers and Jews had it coming. My views on America outlook have not nor will change. While I confess, I disagree with the actual way they say the case took place. James, I'll leave it up to you to clear this up. Wait until I die to tell of my good and Jeff Denton's roles we played in the death of Richard Barrett. Wait for his death too. James, I trust you. What do you make of this? What do you make of this? Just clear and direct. They had it coming. My views will never change. You know, I'm refining my code. You know, I'm talking to a nigga. I'm writing letters. I'm calling him brother, friend, Conrad. But my views will never change. Yes. Yes. More information is needed like this. Edgar Ray have been a preacher for a long time. I don't know why they keep, you know, mentioning the fact that he's a preacher when he didn't, you know. They say he wasn't like, you know, your typical Sunday preacher at the church. He was just ordained. But Edgar Ray had been a preacher for a long time, and he believed firmly in the kingdom of heaven beyond this mortal world, the religion of white supremacy. That's the belief, because if they're following the same, you know, Bible as, you know, non-white people or anybody else that, non-white people, non-white Christians, yeah, you know, murder, killing is bad. Forgiveness is, you know, what it's all about, the basis is about. But, you know, I killed these niggers and, you know, I'll do it again and my views will never change. We need to understand better what they mean by, you know, Christianity, their religion, preachers. Okay, wow. Now, here we are, chapter 12, The Truth Behind Mississippi Burning. Senator, remember I talked about his name, been mentioned many a time, Senator James Oliver Eastland, Democratic United States Senator from 1941 through 1978, representing the state of Mississippi, Chairman of the State Judiciary Committee 1957 through 1978, President pro tempore of the Senate 1972 through 1978, third in line for presidency, close friend of, get this, listen to these names, President Lyndon Johnson, Vice President Joe Biden, Senator Ted Kennedy, and Senator Phil Hart. And you wonder why you have a 94 crime bill. And, you know, someone's on the Breakfast Club talking about, if you don't vote for me, you're not black. And, you know, you get into, and, you know, all the other little, not little, but the acts of, you know, racist aggressions that you've seen from him. Look where he comes from. Look who his network is. More information is needed on this system. Fact, you know, that's not even conjecture. It's not up for debate with me anymore. Look, here we go. Here's a quote from James Eastland to Senator Jacob Javits. I don't like you or your kind. At the time, okay, yeah. He went in on Jacob Javits. Okay. Eastland and Johnson, next part. The truth is going to shock you. There's probably, okay. This is more in depth about, you know, the power, the government connections of the system. The truth is going to shock you. There's probably no one else more qualified to tell this, because the plan that was hatched by the CIA was dropped right in my lap. Being the leader, I was in the South, and speaking from public places, I was accepted by all white and conservative people, so the media called it Klan. Remember, it was dangerous to be right when your government is wrong, of which is in the case they were. My relationship with Senator Eastland, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, allowed me to legally listen to the audio tapes of President Lyndon B. Johnson ordering the illegal plans for the South. The Vietnam War was Johnson's political nightmare, and the media controlled by communists was taking every advantage. Johnson knew this war was ruining him from every political angle. I so well remember how terrible and disgusting LBJ would say, GD war, GD media, and finally, GD South. LBJ ordered Justice to send CIA and FBI into the South, especially Mississippi, and start a racial war between blacks and whites. So we now find our CIA government financing and protecting a communist training center on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, recruiting and training black males to rape white women in Mississippi. I always got to be raped at least once a week. So here comes 1964, and three recruiters were missing on June 21st, 1964. The media forgot about Vietnam and moved to Mississippi. The CIA was under orders to keep any persons who attended communist training school under 24-hour surveillance. Godwin got to Mississippi June 20th, 1964 and disappeared. Oh, good one. Sorry, I said Godwin. Disappeared June 21st, 1964. Where was the CIA and the FBI? Did they kidnap these three? Were they there obeying orders? Just what did happen? You know, this is very indicting of LBJ, which I don't know how many people, you know. I mean, let me take that back. He did sign the Voting Rights Act. So, you know, he appeared to be a progressive white person, and he was also Democrat. And that's this is around the time when, you know, a lot of non-white black people, you know, started becoming Democrats, and the stronghold is there. And it's alleged that Lyndon Baines Johnson said, you know, I'll sign this Voting Rights Act and these niggers will be voting Democrats for the next such and such 100 years. It's alleged that he said these things, and, you know, this just kind of confirms that, you know, there were ulterior motives. It was, really wasn't for the true benefit of non-white people receiving justice in the system. So, like I said, information is key. I'll keep saying that because information is everything. Yeah, Edgar clarified with me that he had a personal relationship with Senior Eastland, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Eastland and Johnson had been close in the Senate, both being Democrats and both rising in the ranks at roughly parallel times. What most of us think is that LBJ was essentially just an extension of JFK's presidency, at least in the spirit of his policies and procedures. According to Edgar, that couldn't be further from the truth. Whenever Martin Luther King Jr. was arrested under Kennedy, he would arrange for the man to be released from jail. John Kennedy was truly a proponent and supporter of the civil rights movement. Everybody assumed that President Johnson would do the same thing. And I'll just pause right there because, you know, a few months ago I started reading Bearing the Cross by David Garrow. He's a historian, a big historian on Dr. King and that whole movement over there. And I remember Dr. King wasn't backing John F. Kennedy early on during, I guess, the primaries or prior to him being nominated as the Democratic selection for presidency, because his stance on civil rights wasn't in line with Dr. King. So to put this notion out that, you know, he was just progressive, he had it all together, I think that's just disingenuous and could be racism if that's, you know, that the handprints of that white writer or white editor. Plantation plots. It was Senator Eastland who said it would be a dark day in hell before integration ever entered Mississippi. James Eastland fought tooth and nail, totally, openly, and wholly, unrepentantly to preserve the segregated nature of Mississippi. When Edgar Ray Killen got to Eastland Plantation, he was prepared to take on his marching orders from this man who had the air of the president of the United States. This is deep. This just isn't, you have access to the president of the United States. This, how deep is that? How many so-called black organizations have that, you know, independent black organizations have that without, some white backing or, you know, some good white folks, so-called good white folks behind you. Just think about it. Think about it. It's crazy. When Edgar Ray got the East, he was prepared to take on his marching orders. When they sat down to meet, Senator James Oliver Eastland shared the plan that he had to incite the people and to distract attention from the Vietnam War. He said, "I need you to come and do something for me, Edgar. I need you to have the boys to start killing every black boy under the age of 16 years old." So let me just go back because this just reminds me of something. Apparently, the Vietnam War was a total nightmare for LBJ. And, you know, he didn't want to deal with it. It was just a political nightmare, as it was stated. So, you know, he devised some plan to take the focus off of that. And like, this is the insidiousness of racism, that they can plan these situations, these little, you know, things that we think are natural situations that spawn into big things. It's these things are planned. And just to hammer home the point, I was reading William Pepper's book about Dr. King, and it's alleged that the plot to get, they say that Dr. King was led to Memphis because of the death of sanitation workers. But if you read his work, that was a work to get Dr. King there. That was planned. So I don't, information is lacking. I'll keep saying that. I'll keep saying it because we don't totally understand. We don't connect the dots as a whole, as a people. Yeah, there's some, and I don't understand everything. I don't have it all figured out, but I'm putting together patterns. And then when I talk to people and try to connect on just logical ideas based off the pattern, it's so much resistance. So I just know that, and you know, there's just a lack of information out there. And this, you know, this is the whole purpose of the program. To, you know, present information, logical information, exchange views. Let me get back on the text. Yeah, we'll probably have to do a part two because, you know, I can't, I'm dead in the meat and so-called meat and potatoes of this text, and now everything, I have to connect everything, all my highlights. So there'll be a part two to this. I'm going to end it right here, and hopefully, I mean, we're just getting started. There's much more to this. There's way more to this. So catch me on part two. We'll continue on and whatnot, and let's solve this problem, produce justice, guaranteeing that no person is mistreated and the person that needs the help gets the most help.